okay.
I'm here. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Luke!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Deal with this prophet. Send assassins.
Fade Rother. He's psychotic.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through. You believe me?
This is a form of power that our world has not yet seen. The ultimate power.
I want you to know I will love you as long as I breathe.
You will never lose me as long as you stay who you are.
Consider what you're about to do, Paul Atreides.
Silence!
Welcome to the Strange Harbors podcast, a weekly discussion of film, television, and pop culture. My name is Jeff Zhang, and tonight I'm joined by
Amir Toure
and Derek Wong.
So this week we are reviewing the much-anticipated and very delayed Dune Part 2, directed by Denis Villeneuve. It is a sequel to 2021's Part 1, and it stars Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Austin Butler, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Lea Seydoux, Stellan Skarsgård, Josh Brolin, and Dave Bautista. Huge cast. And I think I speak for most of us when I say that Christopher Nolan is breathing a sigh of giant relief that this movie was delayed to 2024. I feel like this would have been big Oscars competition for Oppenheimer if it was released in the same year. Because this was due to come out last November.
Mm-hmm.
And then the strike delayed it?
Yes.
I think with the caveat that this is still more genre fiction than Oppenheimer, which is sort of more squarely in Oscar bait category, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
This would still have maybe swiped away some of the stuff Oppenheimer got. I don't know. It would have been competition anyway.
I don't want to say they're similar directors, but I think they occupy similar space where they're just beloved auteurs. They make big movies.
You've actually long thought this, because for those who haven't listened to our Dune episode, go listen to Part 1. Jeff talks about Denis as being like one of the few who's operating in that space, and Nolan's the other one. You've thought this for a while now.
Yeah. Should we talk a little bit about Denis Villeneuve? I'm sure we've spoken about him in the previous Dune episode, but what are your thoughts on Mr. Villeneuve?
I'll go first, because as I said in the last pod, I'm the least big Denis head. I don't think I love anything he's done prior to this. I mean, Sicario's good. Arrival's very, very good. 2049, kind of meh. The first Dune grew on me, but initially I was kind of cold on it. So, not the world's biggest Denis head.
Not a 2049 fan?
Nah, it was just okay to me. And yeah, I mean, spoiler alert, this one converted me, man. Dune Part 2 is my favorite Denis movie, hands down. What about you guys?
I think I probably said it. Pretty big fan. I've been loving most of his stuff. Prisoners, Sicario, Arrival. I'm pretty cold kind of like Amir on 2049. I think I'm like probably somewhere in the middle of you two maybe. But, you know, I loved Dune. It was in my top 10 for that year. So I was definitely looking forward to the continuation.
I'll caveat my statement with it made my top 10 too. I warmed up a bit after first viewing.
Interestingly enough, I've cooled on Villeneuve a little bit, actually. Because I've seen most of his stuff as they were coming out. And I spent maybe the last couple weeks kind of revisiting his movies. I think they're very good movies. I think I like a lot of them. But there's just something missing with the way that he
empty about them.
Makes the movies. Something empty about it. I couldn't put my finger on the emptiness or what exactly rubbed me the wrong way with some of his movies. But someone actually mentioned that his characters don't seem to live outside the frame. And I think that's a very, very clever and astute way of putting how he directs movies.
Do you have like an example of that? Let's say in Dune.
Okay, so Dune, I think, is the exception. Dune Part 1 and Part 2 together make for probably Denny's strongest two films. I mean, to be honest, they're like one film, really, if you put them together, because Part 1 ends quite abruptly. And I kind of want to say that I blame Dune for this pandemic of Part 1s and Part 2s where they're being cut off at random points. And, you know, you got like Across the Spider-Verse, Dead Reckoning Part 1. I don't know. Maybe it's not to blame.
No, I don't think it is. Didn't like the last Harry Potter movie did that or something, right?
Yeah.
An old trend.
It just seems like it started there. You know what I mean? Maybe it's not directly responsible for it.
Okay, if Dune's a bad example, can you point something out in like Arrival or Sicario? Like, I'm trying to grasp what you're saying.
I think Arrival is a good example. I still really love Arrival, but I kind of wonder what that movie would look like in another director's hands, because it's such a humanist story and it just seems a little clinical to me. I think Denny likes to go really big for whatever he's doing, and he tends to crowd the human elements to outside the frame. They just don't seem to be living anywhere outside of what you're looking at. I think that goes for a movie like Sicario or Prisoners too. But he's a very, very talented image maker, and I think he makes really good movies, but there's just something missing there that doesn't put him on the level of, I don't know, say Nolan or someone like that, you know?
So it's interesting you say that, because Nolan often gets hit with the too clinical critique as well.
Yeah, I agree.
And then I think he's stunting on the haters, because Oppenheimer was just this tremendous, incredible artistic and commercial success. And so I think he sort of maybe overcome that. And I think, like you said, with Dune, Denis is also overcoming his worst, I don't know, his worst impulses or his worst weaknesses, because these last two films from these guys who you're comparing earlier both seem to have them transcending their earlier sort of habits.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an esoteric complaint because you can't really quite put your finger on it, because I don't think Dune Parts 1 or 2 really fixes the issue, but I felt it less with these two, especially together. So I actually am embroiled in like beef on Twitter because I'm a big Avatar defender and James Cameron defender, and people are pitting Dune against Avatar, which I think is stupid. But I think where James Cameron excels is where I think Villeneuve is a little lacking, which is like the human element, where James Cameron is so earnest and wears everything on his sleeve, and people mistake it for like corniness, but I find that very, very refreshing, and it makes me connect with the characters in a way that, you know, some of Villeneuve's films don't.
Now it's like has me trying to reevaluate, and I haven't seen, and I didn't take the time to rewatch a lot of Villeneuve's stuff, so it would be an interesting exercise to go back and see what you're seeing.
I didn't really see it until I revisited a lot of these movies, because Arrival was on my top 25 of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was on a lot of our top 25s of the decade.
I think it was on mine, right? Too, yeah.
Both of you, yeah.
But I still think it's a great movie. I love that movie. My opinion's just diminished a little bit, I think.
Okay.
Also, I've seen it so many times.
Should we get into what we thought about this movie?
Well, first of all, I want to ask, did you guys see it in large format?
I just saw it at a regular movie theater. I couldn't get to an IMAX, unfortunately. I was so hyped for this movie. I was toying with the idea of like taking a long drive or flying to a big IMAX, but it just didn't work out.
That's crazy.
That's dedication.
I thought about it, dude. Yeah. I was pretty hyped. I was pretty hyped for this. As much as I dogged part one a little bit, I was pretty damn hyped for part two. Because yeah. I saw part one in IMAX, and so I was like, oh man, part two is going to be so good in IMAX. And it would have been. So I'm jealous of people who got to see it that way.
I got to see this, the big chain around in our area, and the only theaters I really have in my area are Regals. So I got to see this in Regals.
Shout out to the sponsor.
I know, right? Please. I got to see it in Regal's Premier RPX format. It's not really quite IMAX. The screen's a little bit larger and it's in Adobe Atmos. The image was very crisp, colors were really nice, and sound was really nice. I do wish my screen was just a tad bit bigger. I do wish I got that experience.
So I saw this in the Warner Brothers screening room, which is just like a standard high-tech screen. So the image was really, really good. But it was like standard movie theater size. So I'm really itching to see this in, I don't know, 70 millimeter IMAX or something.
That's what I was dreaming about. I was like, oh, I wanted the 70 millimeter IMAX so bad.
I know. But I was looking at some of the tickets for this thing. It's fucking wild.
Dude, booked up. People are really into Dune.
Yeah. 3:15 a.m. screening, completely sold out except for the front row. At Lincoln Square.
I looked at that screening.
I've never even seen like a Marvel movie perform like that.
But interestingly enough, it didn't quite reflect in the box office though, right? Like this thing domestically over the weekend didn't hit over 100 million, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are having like these sold out screens. Mine wasn't sold out. It was still a good amount of people, but it wasn't sold out. And I didn't have the same troubles as you guys trying to find a screening for this.
You know what it is? I think it's the New York Lincoln Square in particular because it's one of the largest in the country, the IMAX, if not the largest. I think it's the largest.
I think it is, yeah.
So it's a lot of cinephiles and enthusiasts really wanting to see it in that format. And it doesn't reflect the rest of the country's enthusiasm for this movie. But it's not a disappointment in any way. I mean, it's pulling Oppenheimer numbers and close to Barbie numbers, right?
This movie will have legs and will benefit from the fact that it's coming out in March.
Yeah, it's going to leg out for sure.
Okay, well, what did you guys think of Dune 2?
I loved it with a couple of reservations, I think. But this is probably 1 and 2 together, one of my favorite sci-fi movie experiences. I think Villeneuve is on top form, and especially if you didn't like part one as much, I think part two makes up for a lot of it. And I think, Amir, you were pretty cold on part one when you first saw it.
Initially, yes.
It did worm its way to your top 10 of 2021. I think your opinion of it has only grown since then, right? Part one.
Yeah, yeah. I like part one more and more the more I see it. And two, I really, really liked a lot. I like it a lot more than part one. The first half to me was probably one of the best science fiction movies I've ever seen. And then I still haven't pinned down exactly what happens in the second half where it starts to lose me a little bit. But it's not quite as strong as that first half. But overall, I still really loved this one. I thought this was great.
What'd you think, Derek?
So I am probably the one that is the coldest on this one. And I was not expecting that.
Interesting.
And then maybe it's the case of I love the first one a lot.
You did. You liked it a lot.
Out of all of us, you know, I liked it the most. No reservations put it on my top 10. I was very excited to watch this one. And this could be a case of high expectations, but trying to remove myself from that, I think my issues kind of, and I think Amir, you're starting to hit on it, is that this movie feels like, you know, the first half or the first even like maybe two thirds of this movie is very coherent and it's speaking to what happens to Paul when he joins the Fremen. It's a lot about the Fremen, building this relationship you have with these characters it's focusing on in this movie and their plight and what it means Paul to kind of become this leader for them. But then I feel like the last third just is accelerated to a point that I think the movie suffers a little bit. You know, we don't get much time or understanding. And maybe it's not in the Dune book, but I feel like I don't really understand like the Fade Rotha character or the Princess Arulin character, Christopher Walken's Emperor. I feel like those are kind of rushed. Those characters to me are not something that I think are fully developed. Maybe it doesn't need to be based on if you read the book and you're like, well, that's for another book. But it does seem like there's a lot of history between these characters that just isn't at all present or able to, for me to like understand their motivations or their relationships.
I actually 100% agree with you. It just doesn't bug me as much.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get that the last maybe quarter or third of the movie is condensed and rushed.
In Denis's defense, though, I think the book does do something similar.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like it is pretty rushed towards the end. I will say that I think Fade Routha gets a little bit more characterization in the books. But essentially everyone else, the Emperor, Princess Irulan, they are pretty thin in the book as well.
It's my lack of understanding of the book that like maybe it's hindering forming my opinion. But it's also going into this knowing that, like you said, Jeff, these two movies representing one movie, it does feel a little too much like it's leaving a lot of cards on the table, that it is feeling like it's setting up a franchise. It's hard for me to reconcile conclusion, like a resolution to this story, even though I think there is, right? I mean, there is like a duel at the end. He does become the new emperor. There is some resolution, but the movie, and I don't know if the book is like this, leaves it very open-ended for like, what does that mean for him now with his marriage with, oh, sorry, so spoilers, but Princess Irulan. And then what does it mean for Lady Jessica character? What does it mean that Lea Seydoux is carrying the baby of Fade Routha? What does it mean that Chani is this person that's left to the side? It's all these things, all these questions that are brought up that just feel like it's too much trying to develop. Well, okay, let's answer those in the next movie. But maybe you guys can speak to like, well, that's exactly what the book does.
I mean, that's exactly what the book does, right?
Yeah.
This is basically, I think if you're expecting part two to be a tidy conclusion, you're going to be disappointed because this pretty much is a middle chapter and it's more elegantly wrapped up than part one, which is just super abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the middle chapter between Dune and Dune Messiah, right?
Is it though? Because you can just read Dune as a book and be satisfied. Because I did for many years. I didn't read Dune Messiah, right?
Yeah.
I think you can read Dune as a whole collected story and go, that is it. Like, okay. Like, you don't necessarily need to go on to more, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you feel that way about the movie, like, just because you know he has expressed interest in going on to Messiah, or if the movie actually is more open-ended. I think it probably is. I think the movie is probably more open-ended than the book on this. It comes to a less satisfying conclusion, probably, because of some of the choices they made.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of it is trying to build out a franchise, and it's less buttoned up than the book. I mean, it's been a decade since I've actually read the book, so I'll probably need a crash course or refresher.
Maybe if what you're saying is true, Jeff, if this is really supposed to feel like a middle chapter, then maybe I have to have some reservations, right? Maybe I need to then, if Messiah is going to come out, reevaluate this again, see that as a trilogy. But it's hard for me when you call one Dune 1 and then Dune Part 2. And it feels like, for me, it should be one complete movie. I guess I don't feel that at the moment.
Yeah, I think if that's the case, that's a failure on the film's part. Because I think you can both wrap up Part 2 and leave room for Messiah, because the book did. I didn't quite feel that, but I can see how you did, because things are sort of open-ended.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was just kind of my reservations. Look, I know I sound a little negative at the moment, but honestly, I also still really enjoyed this movie. If you're asking me, should I go see this movie in a theater? I'm absolutely going to say yes. There are just some shots, some set pieces in this movie that have to be seen in a theater. And honestly, it's a spectacle. Like, and I remember talking about Dune 1, right? Like, I remember feeling so good about Dune Part 1 because it was such a spectacle. It made me feel like this was our Star Wars, right? This was our time to be in a theater and watch this epic spectacle of a movie. And I think that still holds true with these two movies together.
So just to give a little synopsis of the movie, so we're all on the same page. This movie takes place immediately after the events of Part 1 with Timothée Chalamet's Paul Atreides and his mother, Lady Jessica, on the run with the Fremen after the massacre of their house by the Harkonnens on Arrakis. The film follows Paul as he acclimates to the Fremen way of life and his budding romance with Chani, played by Zendaya, and their plan to take the planet back from their enemies.
I mean, let's talk about some of these scenes, right? I think the opening set piece was amazing. I think that black and white fight scene is honestly one of the best things I've seen in a long time.
The infrared camera scene on Getty Prime.
Yeah.
The Harkonnen gladiator fight.
Yeah. And even just the last set piece of Paul versus Vader Atha, that was pretty awesome.
So from the beginning, like one of my complaints about the first one is it's not weird enough. And so for when this movie starts out with Paul's sister, who's a fetus, and like images of her talking to Paul, I was like, okay, Denny's got the juice this time. He's going to do it. So that's not an action set piece, but I loved that he went weird with this one. And just from the very beginning, I was like, oh, he's going to do it. He's doing it. I like that a lot.
Can we dive a little deeper into this then? Okay, did I miss something in Dune Part 1? Are we supposed to know that she's pregnant?
Yes.
I did a rewatch last week, and I did clocked her like holding her stomach, being worried about her abdominal region, but I thought she was just injured. Was there something vocal about, oh, she's pregnant at this moment? Did Leto know? Does Paul know? At the beginning of this movie, when he's like, how's my sister? I'm like, wait, what? I don't remember there being a sister or like, her being pregnant.
I know for sure it's in the books. I don't recall if it's explicitly said in part one. I thought it was, but you're saying you just saw it again and it's not mentioned. So then.
Yeah, I can't extricate my knowledge of the books from how long ago I've seen part one. So also, this is a huge change from the book, if you don't know that, right?
Please explain.
Because in the book, Alia is a toddler already by the time part two rolls around.
Oh.
And the movie changes it so that it's a fetus. That is such a weird, ingenious change to the book. I love it. I think it's so well done.
There's a 2-year time jump in the books, right?
Yes.
The things we see Paul doing, like becoming part of the Fremen tribe and participating in these attacks on the Harkonnens and making friends and alliances and spreading his legend, all that takes place over 2 years in the books. So that time gap is just completely cut out in the movie. And I think it's explicitly so that you don't have to show the toddler. So what's going on with Alia, which is his little sister, is that during her gestation, Jessica takes the water of life, that toxin that we see in this movie in part two.
Mm-hmm.
She takes the toxin slash hallucinogen that comes directly from like the bodies of the dead drowned sandworms, the little baby drowned sandworm, that blue goo, right? So mm-hmm. She drinks that. What that does is that unlocks your ancestral memories and like your ability to commune with all of the Reverend Mothers in the past, opens up Jessica's mind so she can communicate with all the past people who've done this. But because Alia is in her stomach and she's a woman, she's a girl, fetus, she can also do that. So as a fetus, she has like the minds of all these other Reverend Mothers downloaded into her mind, even though she's a fetus.
Yeah, she gains sentience.
Yeah, so she's born, and like as a toddler, she's walking around and talking about things she couldn't know, and she's just like completely adult. She's never really fully a child. And so she's a very weird, creepy character in the books.
Yeah.
She's a 2-year-old running around, knifing dead Harkonnen soldiers and stuff like that.
I don't know how that would translate into a movie.
It would have been really difficult.
I think David Lynch did it in his movie, and people really knocked it for that. So how do you get a toddler actor to act like that? I don't know, without being so goofy. That's why I think this change is so good, to have the psychic fetus, you know, with the water of life coursing through it and speaking psychically instead of actually being a toddler, which would be, I think, a little too goofy. You know, it's a great change. I really do like it.
I do like the idea that instead of us having this large time jump, there is a change in time throughout this movie, right? Because we see Paul doing all these raids with the Fremen. His relationship grows with the Fremen. I like that we don't ever leave that. We actually get to see his relationship with the Fremen evolve. And I like that, you know, over time we get to see that his eyes change and all that kind of stuff. So I think those are really cool indications of time. I will say that the Jessica thing talking to the fetus was, because of my lack of knowledge, I didn't know if that was real or if that was like a ruse, right? Because a lot of times she talks about how, oh, we have to convince people that Paul is the Messiah, right? This prophet, that maybe I will play my part by, you know, feeling like I'm talking to this baby. But then quickly is I do realize, okay, she actually is talking to this baby. But at first I was kind of confused if this was real or not.
I can see how it would be confusing if you didn't know what it was doing, right?
But I do think it's pretty weird in the movie, and I think it's even weirder in the book. But I like that Denny made an adaptational choice, and I think this is one that works. I agree with you, Jeff.
Yeah, it pays off. One of the things I really like about this movie is that it very closely sticks to the themes of the books, and it is not a feel good movie. I kind of felt like shit coming out of this movie, I'm not gonna lie. I really did like it. It's a bleak fucking movie, and I think it's funny that there are people who are misreading it. Oh, hell yeah, Paul Atreides, right? But he basically becomes Space Hitler at the end. So it's a very feel-bad kind of movie, and I really like what it says about, you know, systems of belief, Bene Gesserit, manufacturing of destiny. It's really, really good. I think it changes things, but it sticks very closely to the themes of the book. I'm not surprised because, you know, this has been Denis Villeneuve's passion project. He's been thinking about Dune his entire life, pretty much, right? And making this movie. So it makes sense that he would be faithful in that regard.
Not to dog him, but this is the knock on Zack Snyder, right? His Watchmen didn't really get it, right?
Yes. Yes.
And so, like, this is the opposite. This is someone who, even though there are adaptational changes, Denis definitely gets it as far as, you know, Herbert's critiques of messiah figures and power and manipulation and all these things. Like, yeah. Denis definitely gets it.
Doesn't escape me. And maybe this was also present in the book, but Paul being white, I don't think I clocked any white Fremen. They were all of some kind of different...
brown or black ethnicity.
Yes. Yeah. 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 In very layman terms, but yeah, brown or
black. It's intentionally very Lawrence of Arabia, right? Like, it's drawing on that, for sure. In the books, you know, the Fremen are even more Arab-coded. Their language, Chikobza, is basically big chunks of actual modern Arabic are part of the Fremen language. And they intentionally chose to de-emphasize that in this adaptation. They got somebody to create the Fremen language. And I guess it seems like, anyway, he was given instructions to de-Arabicize the Fremen language because there's only a couple of things that remain, which I think is a shame.
Yeah, I gotta say that stinks. That's like my big critique of the movie. And this movie, you kind of have to thread the needle on representation within it because there are people who are critiquing the movie about white savior tropes, which this is not. It's a purposeful...
He has to be white.
Yeah. It's a subversion of the white savior trope. And, you know, there are people who are disingenuously saying, oh, you know, Lady Jessica and Paul are appropriating the Fremen culture, which is part of the text of the movie.
It's true. They are appropriating it, and it's bad.
It's a bad thing.
And the movie understands that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I don't think it's disingenuous. I think they're just dumb and wrong. Like, they don't understand the movie.
Yeah, but also, on the other hand of it, I think the erasure and the de-Islamicization of the Fremen culture and the language is kind of cowardly.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they made that artistic choice. I'd have to really look into it. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't like it. I think maybe part of it is that Denis sees, I don't know, he's French-Canadian, right?
Yeah, I think it's a Hollywood thing.
It could be. I was wondering, is it a Quebecois thing? Like, is it, I don't know.
I don't think it's a Quebecois thing. I think it's just a Hollywood thing where, you know, the big term that Frank Herbert throws around in the book is jihad. And I think Hollywood is very uncomfortable with that. So
sure.
In getting rid of that word, they just walked back the entire language and got someone to invent the Fremen language. And I think that goes into the casting, too, because there are no Arab actors in this except for Shehela Yaqub, who plays Chani's friend in this. Mm-hmm. But in part one, there are no characters, no Arab actors at all. So I think that is just a bed that they made from part one and they had to lie in it. But it is glaring. Especially because you're commenting on appropriation and...
Right, and that you're doing
belief and stuff like that, right?
Ironically, if they'd kept in the jihad term, they could have counted on people's racism to help them understand the story more. Like, oh, wait, this is bad, right? Like, if they'd kept the term jihad, people might have gone, wait a minute, jihad? Maybe Paul is not good. Whereas it seems like they're not getting it for what you're saying, Jeff.
Yeah.
I mean, another reason I think maybe people aren't getting it is... Denny chose to make the visions to the future pretty hazy and confused, which I think is fine and makes sense with the book and, you know, prescience isn't perfect and stuff. I think a little bit of clarity on the visions would have gone a long way if you saw those Fremen legions really sweeping over planets and murdering people and all the piles and piles of skulls and, you know, just sweeping across the galaxy. That might have made it more clear that, oh yeah, this is the fate that Paul is strenuously trying to avoid until he finally succumbs to it, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to say the movie depicts Paul as a bad person, but I like that he's backed into this destiny where it's from his visions, right? He has to choose the least bad outcome for him. And even then, it's billions dead in the name of his holy war, right? As Lisan al-Ghaib. So it makes for a thornier movie, and I like that.
So, okay, I want to go back to this idea that is Paul bad or not? Because I have read or heard people's interpretation of this movie as he's using Chani the whole time.
What?
I did not read it like this. But I've heard interpretations where he's using her and like doesn't actually care about her. Is that, based on Herbert's writing, is that not true?
Based on the book, that is 1,000% incorrect.
Okay.
I guess people are reading it as, oh, he's like a manipulator. And so he was using her to get to Irulan. And so I can see why people make that mistake. It's 1,000% clearer in the book that that's not what is going on. And part of that is the adaptational choice they've made between the book and the movie. So in the book, Chani is like a loyal advisor and counselor. She is on his side as he directs his Fremen to conquer the galaxy. Like, she's totally with it. Whereas in the movie, she's a foil. She's like this indigenous Fremen and atheist who's against the religious prophecies, against the Bene Gesserit, and against Paul falling into this trap of destiny. They give her sort of a bigger role in the movie. I'm not sure I agree it's a bigger role. They give her a clearer role as a foil as a comparison to Paul. But then that makes it less clear that they have an incredibly strong, loving relationship in the books. Another thing that's cut away with this time jump is that in the book, Chani actually has a child. They have a kid, and their kid is killed by the Harkonnens.
Oh, wow.
Leto, too.
Yeah, so their kid is killed by the Harkonnens in the book. They're married, they have a kid, they're deeply, deeply in love, but he cannot marry her because he has to marry Irulan in order to secure his grip on the throne. And so the parallel that's drawn directly is to his father, who didn't marry the Lady Jessica. I don't know if you remember, but the Lady Jessica is technically a concubine. Oscar Isaac's Duke Leto says, I should have married you, right? But he's supposed to keep his marriage options open in order to be able to strengthen the house or make marriage alliances and so on. So Chani suffers the same fate as Jessica in the second half of Dune. Paul has to marry Irulan, but he makes a promise to her. He's like, I'll never love her, she'll never share my bed, we'll never have children. It's a completely political alliance and no more. She'll have nothing from me. And the last sentence of the book is Jessica saying, I feel sorry for Irulan, Chani, because she's going to get nothing of Paul. And in the end, those of us who are called concubines were truly the wives. It's not exactly what he says. But it ends on this like, explicit parallel between the two of them, which is completely lost here because they went a completely different way. And it's unfortunate because it actually is a really beautiful ending.
I'm very conflicted on these changes.
On the Chani change. I get why they did it. They wanted someone to be like, hey, Paul, don't be space Hitler. And so like they chose Chani to do that. And it is kind of a slightly beefier role, if only because, okay, now she's conflicting with Paul instead of just kind of going along with him.
Yeah, it gives her a little agency.
A little more to do, I guess. But I'm pretty conflicted on it as well because I don't know. I like that original Chani character. I think it makes the emotional beats of the movie a little bit difficult for me because you wonder, with all her objection to his Lisan al-Ghaib-ness, it makes you wonder how deep is their relationship, right? In the books, you don't doubt it. And in the first half of this movie, you don't doubt it either. But then you wonder, like, how together are they? It's not as clear to me.
Yeah. I think this is my favorite Timothée Chalamet role.
Okay.
I think he does a great job here. And I've never been a huge fan of him, but he kills it here. I think he's really, really good. Most of the cast is really, really good. I love Austin Butler as Fade Rautha. Such a twisted villain, but he also has like a weird sense of honor and a code.
He's a weird little freak. And yeah, we mentioned it already, but that gladiatorial combat on Getty Prime looks awesome.
Yeah.
That black and white infrared thing and the liquid fireworks and the black sun.
Yeah.
It rolls, dude. Again, I criticize Denis for not making part one weird enough and part two is making up for it in spades. There's a lot of really weird, cool imagery in this movie.
Yeah, I was blown away when I realized that the black and white wasn't like a stylistic choice. I mean, it is, but it's actually like in universe that it's monochrome because of the black sun, which is super fucking cool. Mm-hmm. He's such a nasty little troll, too, because when he's dueling Paul, Paul's like, may my knife chip and shatter. And then he's like, may my knife chip and shatter, you know? He's such a little shit. I love that. It's so good.
I brought it up earlier. You don't see stuff like that. The starkness of it, right? In contrast to anything you see in theaters now, like, it's just such a creative choice.
Yeah.
But actually, before we jump too far ahead, I actually really also love the first set piece. We kind of enter the movie back where we left off, right? They're carrying the body of Janis, and some of the Harkonnen troops catch up to the Fremen. They disperse left and right, and they tell Paul to just chill there. They fake out the Harkonnen troops by using this thumper. They think a worm's coming, so they float up and scale up this rock. That shot of them just all in line, and you just see the sun in the background, that shot is just beautiful.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, that's instantly iconic, I think.
Yeah.
I don't throw the word iconic around lightly, but there's a lot of stuff in this movie that is like
they
that.
They fly now?
They fly now, yeah. That's They Fly Now done correctly, though, right? It's such a cool visual.
Yeah. The scene is so cool, too, right? They're all up there, and like they're just getting taken out left and right. There's a little fight scene with Paul. That scene was really cool.
Yeah. And one parallel that I noticed in the movie that I really liked was, you know, in the beginning when they kill all the Harkonnen soldiers, they do all this stuff to the bodies, you know, like drain it of the water, and they have their own rituals. But then by the end, when they're doing the assault and taking back the planet, they're just piling up the bodies and burning them, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's none of that. Yeah, it's such a great parallel. It's really fucking harrowing, I think.
It's a great touch.
Yeah, it's a really good touch.
Yeah, I love that scene, that first raid. And then I love the second raid, too, where he and Chani have to work to the rocket launcher to down the ornithopter, and they're running underneath the legs of the crawler and shit.
So
dude,
good.
It's dope. And the Fremen are popping out of the sand. Dude, it rules so hard. And, like, the laser guns and the rockets they're using. It's just cool sci-fi spectacle shit. It rocks, man. It's really cool. I think that first half of part two is just so cool with all that stuff back to back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
It's just cool.
And even that shot of the sniper looking at Paul and then panning over and it's Chani.
Yes.
But she's already shot, right? And like she's lowering her rocket and you're just like, oh, that's cool. And you just see the missile hitting the side of the helicopter and then just exploding. That was a really cool shot.
Yeah, it's great. There's just so much that really rocks here. I think we talked already about Fade and how great the Giddy Prime scene is. The final duel with Paul is great. And then his stuff with the Lady Fenring is great. I really like Lea Seydoux here.
Yeah, she's really good.
Does a great job of being like a creepy Bene Gesserit seductress. It's cool. I think that's a cool little role.
I'll give it to Denny because he does it in part one also, where you're under the influence of the Bene Gesserit. There's this loss of time sometimes, right? They make you do something and you don't remember. This sequence between Fade and the Lea Seydoux character, him moving through these spaces without him realizing he's in complete control. I thought that representation of that power was much better represented in this movie.
Yeah. I loved all the instances of Paul using the voice, especially towards the end before the duel, where the Reverend Mother telling him, like, be careful what you're about to do. And he's just like, silence, you know, and then he uses the voice. And then, you know, Fade Rautha's like a little turned on or something. He's like, ooh, the voice, you know, it's fucking great. What a great little moment for both those characters.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Rewatching part one, I love that they carried over Paul's fake psychic friendship with Jameis. I think that's such an interesting character dynamic where, you know, in the first movie, he has visions of Jameis and they're like friends. He's like a mentor character for him, a Fremen mentor. But when he meets him at the end of part one, he's completely antagonistic and hostile and he has to duel him to the death. And they carry that relationship on in the second movie where he still has visions of Jameis as a friend. I think that's so cool. And also maybe the funniest part of the entire movie, because he has a vision of Jameis and Jameis is like, oh yeah, you totally just have to be Space Hitler now. That's what you gotta do, right?
Speaking of funny parts of the movie, we haven't talked at all about Javier Bardem's Stilgar.
Dude, Stilgar's so funny.
He's so funny in this movie. It's like, the Mahdi's too humble to admit he's the Mahdi. He's the Mahdi. Dude, it rules.
The memes that are coming out, real good.
Yeah, it's just Paul doing all these little magic tricks, and then Stilgar's like, Lisan Al-Ghaib or whatever. Yeah. It's so funny.
It's him.
Detaching his thumb in that kid's magic. Yeah. It's so funny.
I think the best one I saw was like him loosening up a really tight jar or something, a jar lid. It's like, it's him. Hilarious.
It's very funny. But it's also kind of creepy because in the end, Stilgar's faction wins out. Paul does embrace his place as messianic prophet / space Hitler. And so all that funny shit of Stilgar earlier in the movie is like, oh shit, this is what it turns into, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if we want to talk about a villain, and not villain in the traditional sense, I mean, I got that from the Lady Jessica character.
She's very sinister in this movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, she understands this prophecy that the Bene Gesserit has already imbued within this Fremen society and understands that if she can trigger these events, these things that people believe in, that she can then round up supporters, right? Like, she knows that he needs to take the Water of Life, and it's the Chani character that needs to bring him back to life. She very smartly and very connivingly sets these things up. I mean, she uses the voice on Chani, right, to get what she wants.
Yeah.
If people think Paul's bad, I think she might be worse.
She's certainly the devil on his shoulder. I mean, she's actually actively manipulating the population and preparing them for his rise, mm-hmm. like against his wishes, right?
Yeah.
In the beginning, he's not even into this. And she's like, no, don't worry. I'm going to sow the seeds for your eventual victory. It's pretty fucked up, right? Because she's manipulating this myth that was implanted there cynically in order to manipulate this population so that they'll follow her son.
Yeah. Because Paul is actively aware of the repercussions of his choices, right?
And he's trying to avoid them.
He's trying to avoid them, right? Because he knows that, you know, if he goes south, that the Holy War will begin. And he spends a lot of the movie trying not to go south and not to do the things that will trigger his visions,
ascension,
right?
Yeah,
his ascension, right? And, you know, like what you're talking about, Derek, I really like the weaponization of faith in this movie mm-hmm. and what these things mean to different people. Like, for the Bene Gesserit, it's just a means to the end, right? It's manipulation, it's manufacturing these destinies for Paul and the rest of the people. And, you know, for the Fremen, it's their only hope against their oppressors. And I think that's such a fascinating dichotomy of what faith means to different people. It's really good.
Yeah, those legends are like planted there cynically and they're fake, but Paul makes them real. He does become their savior.
Yeah.
Right? He does actually become the Lysan Al-Ghaib. He is also the Quetzalcoatl, right? You know, the lie becomes a truth. So it's really good stuff. I think they nail that aspect of the books. I think it's just great.
Even Paul himself puts a lampshade over it. There's a point in the movie where he's like, yeah, my mother knew this, so she did it that way.
Oh, she changes the water of life. Yeah, he goes, oh no, that's a Bene Gesserit trick. They're like immune to poisons. They can modify the poison in their body.
Yeah, yeah. Every step he's trying to stop this prophecy, but in the end, he succumbs to it.
My question is, for the Fremen myths and legends, are they manufactured by the Bene Gesserit? Or do the Bene Gesserit infiltrate the Fremen millennia ago and they just have intimate knowledge of their prophecies and they plant operators to take advantage of their faith? They don't actually create the Fremen mythology, right? They just take advantage of it, right?
Yeah, I think they modify it slightly and manipulate it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they've done that in this world thousands of years before Dune or whatever.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's like their entire purpose. The Bene Gesserit are so cool.
Yeah, they're incredibly cool. This universe has just like a lot of just really cool sci-fi shit in it that just rocks. One thing which is a cool bit of casting but didn't actually do so much for me was Christopher Walken's Emperor Shaddam IV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he played it pretty straight.
Yeah, he didn't get to do a ton. And it's not a huge role, I guess, in the books either. I kind of wanted to see more. It's a cool casting just because of the Fatboy Slim video, you know?
Yeah.
That whole song that's about Dune, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Weapon of Choice. but he doesn't do a ton.
Walk without rhythm if you want to avoid the worm, right?
I was going to say, I mean, I feel people like Stellan Skarsgård and Austin Butler just had way more to cook with, right? When in terms of being the shitholes that they were and chewing up the scenery that they got to versus, you know, someone like Christopher Walken. Who kind of agreed. It's a very small role, kind of almost a little thankless, actually, by the end of it.
Yeah, it kind of was. One thing I wish they'd found room for, this is another little bit of book political manipulation that the movie doesn't quite have room for, is Baron Harkonnen sends Raban, the Dave Bautista character, to Arrakis to be a brutal dictator, but he does it as a political move. So he knows that Raban is stupid and brutal. And he intentionally has him ramp up spice production beyond what the planet can tolerate, brutalize the populace, so that Fade can come in as a savior. So there's like a bit of political intrigue there that isn't quite there in the movie. It's just like, oh, Raban's an idiot, toss him out, put Fade in. But like, that was done intentionally in the books.
Because yeah, this movie makes it seem more like that Dave Bautista character just can't get rid of the Fremen, and it's disrupting the spice production, and that's why he brings in Fade.
Yeah, he can't in the books either. That part is true.
Oh, okay.
But in the books, Raban is set up to fail.
Mm.
And the Baron also doesn't really know about the Fremen either, right? Because at the end of the movie, he's taken before the Emperor and the Emperor's Bene Gesserit witch, and she can tell if he knows the truth. And, like, he hasn't put together yet that Paul is Muad'Dib.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And they also haven't really put together yet how many Fremen are on the planet or how much trouble they're in, right?
Yeah.
They don't quite clearly know that. There's a whole bunch of like political maneuvering in the book that unfortunately doesn't make it to the screen. And I get why, and I'm not mad, but it does suck that we miss out on some of that stuff. Like, for example, Thufir Hawat, the Mentat from the first movie.
Stephen McKinley Henderson, sorely missed in this movie.
Unfortunately, he doesn't make it to the movie, which sucks. And I know he filmed some stuff, and I guess we're not going to get to see it.
I remember in our first conversation, or our first podcast, I asked about him, right? Like, I asked about these humans that are basically computers.
The Mentats,
yeah. They're super fascinating, but they totally dropped them in the second movie.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, because he does have a cool little plot line where he's captured by the Harkonnens. This is book spoilers. I don't know. Go read the book. But he's captured by the Harkonnens, and they feed him a poison and keep the antidote. Baron uses him as a replacement for his Mentat, who died in the Leto's poison gas attack.
That was David Dalsmalchian character, right?
Yes, the David Dalsmalchian character who's killed. So he's just Hawat as a replacement for him. So Hawat is working with the Baron, thinking that Paul is dead, because no one knows that Paul is alive and is Muad'Dib, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he's been working kind of against Paul sort of this whole time, not knowing, working on the Harkonnen side. So there's bits of intrigue in there. There's some intrigue between Fade and the Baron in this little bit of a struggle for power. You know, the Baron's trying to raise Fade up as his successor. And Fade doesn't want to wait, and he tries to assassinate the Baron. And there's a lot of back and forth, interesting stuff. I don't know if you remember Lea Seydoux during the duel. She says, oh, plans within plans, when the Baron lets an undrugged slave through.
In the I thought that was cool.
Combat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like one of the things that has multiple layers in the book that you don't see so much in the movie.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, there's not room for everything.
Yeah. Speaking of that, and I think this was one of my criticisms I've already kind of brought forth, but this movie brings to light a lot of things that don't get resolved, and they do feel like they're going to get maybe resolved in the future. The Lea Seydoux carrying the baby of Fade Rotha, the idea of these missiles, atomic missiles that Paul finds in the movie.
Well, he does use them in the final assault.
So, okay, that's one of my questions. So that was one of the missiles.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I didn't know if that was just like a really powerful missile or it was one of those missiles. And then a big one is we get the reveal that Anna Taylor-Joy is the adult version of Aaliyah character. I'm like, I guess if there's a future movie, we already know who's cast as Aaliyah, you know?
They gloss over a bunch of things, too. Mm-hmm. So the reveal that Jessica is a Harkonnen.
That right? too, yes. Yes, that too.
They don't really do anything with that. And the fact that Fade Rautha is supposed to get with whoever the female version of Paul was supposed to be, because, you know, he's a man, right? And they're supposed to get together to
Kwisatz Haderach. The Better Geniuses, they're not just telepathic
eugenicists,
political advisors. Yeah. They're also eugenicists. And so they're trying to manipulate, you know, the bloodlines of all these great houses. And so their plan was to bring together Fade Rautha and Paul, who was supposed to be a girl. But Jessica disobeys her masters in the Bene Gesserit and makes him a boy, right? And he becomes the Kwisatz Haderach a generation early. It was supposed to be, hypothetically, Paul as a female in Fade Rautha. And their child was
and
supposed
their child,
to be the Kwisatz
Haderach,
their messiah figure who could see back into like the male ancestral memory and like would be under their control. Now he's out of their control because he came too early and it's not what they wanted. There's some other stuff there with the Bene Gesserit too in the book that don't come forth in the movie. For example, Margot Fennering, the Lea Seydoux character, implants Fade with like a trigger word to paralyze him so they can control him anytime. If you just like say the trigger word, he'll be paralyzed. And so Jessica gives the word to Paul in the final duel. So like he has that potential upper hand, but if he uses it, he's in the Bene Gesserit's debt, right? Mm. You know, there's like that aspect too, which isn't touched on here, which I think is fine. It's just another little wrinkle, another little complication.
Yeah. Where part one's a little empty, I think the action in part two is really good. And, you know, people have criticized Villeneuve as not being a great action director, but he gets it done here.
Yeah, this stuff's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. The rocket launcher assault is good. You know, taking down the Ornithopter like we talked about. Riding the worm is fucking amazing.
Yes, we didn't talk about riding the worm this whole time.
I know. It's huge. It's so good.
The final worm assault, too.
Yeah, yeah.
This movie actually just has so many cool set pieces we, like, forgot a major one so far.
I was going to say, when you asked what format do we see this movie, I was like, I wish I saw it in 4DX. I wish I could have felt like I was riding a worm. But yeah, we haven't even touched on the worm stuff. You have a good visual of the worm in, like, Dune 1, but I think it just really ramps it up with the whole riding of it in this one. I could not stop thinking about, how do they get people on the worm? Like, how do they get so many people on the worm? It's like a fucking subway. Like, I had so many questions, but it's a really cool visual.
And it's kind of Jawsy, where like you don't see the full figure of the worm. You see like the sand wake of the worm, not fully above the surface. And then finally, in that final attack, you see the three huge worms rearing up into the air.
And everything that's cool in this movie is tinged with, oh, fuck, this is all leading to Paul's ascension, which he doesn't want, you know? And I think that's just a great shading of the themes of the movie. It's really good. It's good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the final duel is great. I thought that was really tense, the knife fight between Fade and Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good.
Really well staged, well shot action. I really, really did like that.
I get what you're saying. Like, as each set piece and each piece of the puzzle kept moving on and moving towards our inevitable end in this movie, you kind of wanted to reach out and be like, no, just stop. If you just don't do that, you'd be fine. You and Chani would be fine, or like you wouldn't fulfill this prophecy. And it did feel like more and more he's losing control of his own situation.
Yeah. It kind of boggles my mind that some people aren't getting it, you know? Because this movie is not subtle about any of this stuff. Paul's ascension is basically scored like a horror movie, and the cuts to Chani's face and her disappointment is not subtle at all. She is the skeptic throughout this whole movie. They spell out the Bene Gesserit plot. It's not very subtle, you know? And I kind of like that. It's not subtle about making you want to feel bad, right? So, not something you really see in a Hollywood IP-based blockbuster. They tend to play it safe, and they want you to feel good and cheer for things. But this is good. I like this. I like this a lot.
You know, we've talked about it being a bad business strategy, but I'm upset there was no same-day HBO Max release because I wanted to rewatch this thing, man.
Yeah, I do remember Dune 1 was that way, right? Dune Part 1?
Yeah. We were able to rewatch it before the episode, and I really want to rewatch this thing because
I know
there's so much in this that's really good. And honestly, I really want to rewatch this in theaters in IMAX, right? I really want that. And I don't know if it'll happen, but
yeah, that
would absolutely rock. It is a big sci-fi spectacle. Denny cranks up the weirdness, which was missing in that first part. Totally worth seeing on the biggest screen you can find.
I would love to see this back to back.
Double feature? Yeah.
Actually sit down and see this almost like a whole movie. I know that would be a really long day. There would have to be some kind of intermission between
intermission,
the two.
Yeah.
You know, if I could dedicate the time, like I would love that experience. It would maybe justify these part one, part two kind of movies a little bit more for me. Where I can see them and like feel them as a whole. And like, I guess I could do it when it comes out on a home video, but let's be honest, I want to see both of them in a theater. Like, I think it'd be a really cool experience.
Yeah. I think it would be kind of a bummer to like watch part one on HBO on your laptop and then go to the theater to watch part two back to back.
That's what I did, basically.
Yeah, I know, right? It's not the same. It's not the same. I would totally go to like a novelty double feature of parts one and two together on IMAX. That would be insane.
That'd be insane.
Yeah, that would rule.
And the thing is, this is the opportunity. I mean, I've talked about this year being a little bit bare. This is the year that we're suffering a little from the strikes. this is coming out in March when it doesn't really have much competition. Theaters are still doing the thing where they're showing movies from 10 years ago, 5 years ago to fill up time. Just carve out 2 or 3 weekends where you can be like, all right, you want to see Dune 2 again? Come out and see Dune 1 and Dune 2 again. I think that would be cool. Hopefully they maybe do that in a couple weeks.
Yeah. I do think that movies are back though. I think people are going to the movies or getting dressed up. Did you see that guy on the motorized sandworm?
Yeah, I saw it.
In the Fremen outfit is so funny. Like riding through the AMC on this motorized sandworm is so funny.
Yeah. Very cool.
I love that people are doing that. It's so great.
Yeah, to see. Is. All right. Well, is there anything else you guys wanted to bring up?
Maybe my favorite, Denis Villeneuve.
Mm-hmm. I think this is my favorite Denis stuff. I really liked part two a lot.
I'm going to count it as one movie, and I do still really like this movie. I want to see the third one, Messiah, come out and see if it feels more of like a finished product before I make an assessment. But as much as I talked about my issues with the movie, I still do really love this movie, and I want people to go see this in theaters, you know, go see it in IMAX. This is it when it comes to movie-going experiences, right? And the last time I said that was probably Avatar: The Way of Water.
Yeah.
We all give it really high marks, and this is definitely one you shouldn't miss in theaters. If that's it, you know, that will conclude this week's episode. Jeff, where can people find more of your work?
You can find me on my blog at strangeharbors.com, and you can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd at Strange Harbors. What about you guys?
You can find me on Arrakis, get lit off the spice, and learn to ride a worm. What about you, Derek?
You're not going
to
do the worm? You're going to ride the worm? No, I'm going to ride the worm. Well, you can find me at Instagram and Letterboxd at The Wrong Day. But if you like this podcast, the easiest way to support our show is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, whether it be Apple, Spotify, Google, or any of the other popular apps. If you're listening to us on Apple or Spotify, please do us a favor and give us a great rating. It really helps to get our voices out to more people.
Yeah, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions on our episode on Dune Part 2, feel free to shoot us an email. We like getting listener mail, and sometimes we read it out on the pod. And with that, we will see you guys next week.
See you next week, everybody.
See you guys then.